We're going to take up an area of church history this morning. It's the area that some of you know I've been asked to cover in lecture form for the folk in Flemington, New Jersey, this coming Tuesday. It has to do with what I'm calling Reformed Baptist, their historical backgrounds in America. Now that's the subject of church history we'll be taking up this morning. In dealing with that subject, I want to say something first of all, before I get to an introduction to it specifically, to the justification we're taking up in a Bible class hour, the whole subject of church history. For those of you who are here regularly, you know that we don't normally do that, but there is biblical justification, and much more biblical justification than if we took this whole hour we could turn you to. But I want you to turn to one passage that we've been looking at frequently in the last several weeks that distinctly concerns the whole doctrine of the church of Christ, and that's Matthew chapter 28. And I'm particularly concerned with the last phrase of verse 20. Jesus, giving the Great Commission, has said to his 11 apostles, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them," these nations that you're going to make disciples out of, "teaching them to observe all that I commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the consummation of the age." And the phrase, "the consummation of the age," is in the context of the Gospel of Matthew and the entire New Testament, a clear reference to the second coming of Christ. And here then is a promise of the risen Christ, to whom all authority has been given in heaven and earth, that he would continue to help and to be present with his disciples as they took his gospel to the ends of the earth. Now this is a promise that in the folds of church history, we can, if we have the mind of Christ and the enlightenment of the Word of God, discern the power, the activity, and the presence of the risen Christ. So that in studying church history, our true goal ought to be to discern there the activity of the risen Christ as he continued to, through his people, teach nations to observe all that he's commanded. We could turn to other passages of the Word of God that show that there will be a process of gradual development and understanding on the part of the Church of Christ as they come to more and more of a distinct, self-conscious understanding of different facets of the Word of God. But this passage alone teaches us the validity of studying church history, because in it we may observe the activity of the risen Christ. Now that being the case, we're going to take up this morning, I'm going to have to straighten this again, I'm sure, Reformed Baptist, their historical backgrounds in America. And first of all, I want to say some things by way of introduction. First of all, something by way of a definition. What do I mean by Reformed Baptist? Well, most of you would have a fairly distinct idea of what that phraseology means. This is a Reformed Baptist church, the distinctly Reformed Baptist Church of Grand Rapids. And I intend, by the term Reformed Baptist, to designate those churches and individuals which have arisen in approximately the last 30 years in the United States of America, and also in other countries, but we're concentrating on those in America, those churches and individuals which have arisen in the last 30 years in the United States, which hold to the confession of faith we've been studying in this hour, the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689, and which often, although not universally, describe themselves as Reformed Baptist. So there is this movement, this group of churches and individuals of fairly small character right now, but that have arisen from nothing over the last 30 years in the United States. And the thing that marks them out is that they hold that confession of faith held by this church, the London Confession of Faith, the London Baptist Confession of Faith of 1689. Now that's my definition of the word Reformed Baptist. But now, a caution. You notice I've limited my theme to Reformed Baptist in America. But it is impossible, first of all, I want to say, to completely separate American Baptist and church history and that of the British Isles. At many, many different points, American church history and American Baptist church history will be directly dependent on what has happened in the British Isles, in England and Wales and Scotland and Ireland. And that I want to say so that you don't get the idea that you can treat America as a totally self-sufficient entity in church history. You can't do that. That wouldn't be right. And it's going to be evident again and again that there's tremendous importance to be placed on events taking in England as affecting American Baptists. Yet, we are Americans, we live in America, and American religious history is distinct, very distinct from the church history of every other country in the world, and thus there is a propriety, a legitimacy of singling out the theme of Reformed Baptist in America. Now, that leads me to a third word of introduction, and that's my mission today. What am I out to accomplish? Well, my thesis is something like this. I believe that Reformed Baptist Christians, if I can put it that way, are strangers in a strange land, to use the biblical phraseology. I think we're strangers in a strange land, and I think many of us are becoming more and more aware as we interact on different levels with American culture just how strange it is to be a Reformed Baptist Christian, strange enough to be a Christian, more strange to be a Reformed Baptist Christian in America. And by showing you why you are strange, I hope to provide you with reasons not to be embarrassed by your strangeness, because normally strangeness is a cause for embarrassment, isn't it? But I hope to give you reasons not to be embarrassed or stumbled by that, based upon a very clear understanding of the legitimacy of what we believe on the basis of the Word of God from church history, in its place in church history. I also hope to prepare you for the offense which others will take at you, because if you believe the Word of God, especially as it's come to expression and to be held by Reformed Baptists in America, you are going to have people taking offense at you. And just as the Apostle Paul said to the Thessalonians, you're suffering affliction, aren't you? Well, I told you before that that was going to happen, didn't I? And why did he tell them before? So that they might be prepared for what was inevitably going to come to people that were as strange as they were in the midst of the first century Roman Empire. Well, Reformed Baptists are very strange creatures indeed in the midst of the 20th century American Empire. And we are going to have to take that into account and expect others to take offense at us. And I want to show you why that's the case. And finally, I hope that a sense of mission, of the mission that and the stewardship the Reformed Baptists, with all the truth that God has shown them, have in America today, a sense of the mission that God has given us, and of course I don't mean to be unduly exclusivistic, but a sense of the mission which anyone that believes the truth of the Word of God in the context of the great heritage of truth that God has taught His church over the ages, the great stewardship that we have in that way and for that reason. Now, then what will our direction be? Well, here's our overall outline. We're going to talk about the rise of particular Baptist in America. Then we're going to talk about the debasement, or the debasing of, that means the kind of polluting, would be the best word, of particular Baptist in America. And then finally, our third point, and I'm quite confident we'll not cover all of this morning in the Sunday school hour, will be the rise of Reformed Baptist in America. So our first two points have to do with what we're calling particular Baptist, and then our third point will have to do with the rise of Reformed Baptist. Now, we come to take up the rise of particular Baptist. Now, I'm very conscious, and I was thinking about this, and a little bit hesitant for this reason. I'm going to move this back a little bit. a little bit hesitant for this reason of taking up church history in the Sunday school hour, because inevitably in teaching church history, I'm going to have to use a lot of names and words that, since many of you have never had a church history course at all, let alone one on American church history, you won't recognize, will you? I mean, the essence of learning is somebody telling you something you don't know. So to learn, you have to learn things you don't know already, right? Well, I'm going to have to use words and names that are going to be strange. Now, here's what I want us to agree to do. I'm going to try to define every word or name that I use that I think you won't understand. But I may miss a few. And if I miss a few, you raise your hand and you tell me, okay? And then I'll define them for you. Because that's a great part of teaching church history and teaching Christians about their heritage in the Christian faith as God has led his people over 20 centuries, simply learning different names and words. So please, if you don't understand a word, raise your hand and tell me. Because I'm not intentionally trying to bowl you over with my great scholarship, even if it did exist. All right? Now, we're going to take up the rise of particular Baptist. That raises very immediately the question, what is a particular Baptist? Right? I told you we'd be using words you didn't understand. Now, I think there are some out there that can define for me as well as I could a particular Baptist. What's a particular Baptist? Who can help us with that? Carl? All right. Particular Baptist were called particular Baptist because they were Calvinist, to use the word. That's a very scary word for some people. Particular Baptist were called that because they believed in unconditional election. They believed in what was known as particular redemption. Some people call that limited atonement. And they believed in irresistible grace and the perseverance of the saints and the total depravity of man. And for that, all of those reasons, they were called particular Baptist, as opposed to another branch of Baptist that developed about the same time that were called General Baptist, because they did not believe in particular redemption or unconditional election. They believed in general redemption. They believed that Christ died for everybody in general and nobody in particular. All right? Now, that's a particular Baptist. A particular Baptist is one who holds to particular redemption and is therefore Calvinistic. Frequently, if not universally, particular Baptists embrace that very confession held by this church, the London Baptist Confession of Faith. Now, the London Baptist Confession of Faith, as I've told you in times past, was actually written in 1677. But they couldn't publish it at the time because Baptists were not allowed to exist formally in England in 1677. It was only 12 years later when toleration came under the reign of William and Mary, the Dutch people that had been imported to rule England in a Protestant way, that in 1689, the London Confession of Faith was published openly in England. And that's the confession that particular Baptists held that was written by them. And we'll say more about where particular Baptists came from later today, this morning. But now, the standard particular Baptist Confession of Faith, then, was the London Confession of Faith held by this church. But now we want to look, first of all, at their roots in America. Their roots in America. Well, how did particular Baptists come to America? That's the question. And how did they rise in America? Well, first of all, they came here through English immigration. Immigration from England. Now, that shouldn't surprise us, since most Americans got here eventually that way, or from one of the other countries in Europe. The English immigration brought to America the particular Baptist tradition. Eventually, in fact, in 1707, there was formed what was known as the Philadelphia Baptist Association, composed of five churches at the time. And this Baptist Association was formed, and with a couple of minor additions, they held to the London Baptist Confession of Faith that had been published in 1689. In 1742, they formally adopted this confession of faith with a couple of minor additions, and it became known in America as the Philadelphia Confession of Faith. And I have a copy of it in my library I could have brought to show you today. But that's the first way in which a particular Baptist came to the United States with English immigration. So particular Baptists that had been raised up in England, sometimes as individuals, sometimes whole churches, left England, migrated to America, and settled for the most part in the Pennsylvania area or the middle colonies. The reason for that was that did not have religious freedom in the southern colonies, where the Anglican church was the state church, and they did not have religious freedom in the New England colonies, where Congregationalists were the state church. And so basically, because William Penn had founded Pennsylvania and given religious liberty there to Quakers, a lot of other odd cats, to use the term, ended up there as well, and among them, a lot of Baptists. Now, an interesting story it occurs to tell me about one of the original Baptist preachers, particular Baptist preachers, in the United States. How many people here have ever heard the name Benjamin Keach? Benjamin Keach, a number of you have. Benjamin Keach wrote a famous Baptist catechism, was one of the signers of the London Confession of Faith of 1689, as I recall. His son immigrated to the United States. And his name was Elias Keach, as I recall. In the Philadelphia area, he presented himself as a preacher. And at the age of 19, got up to preach his first sermon. The fact was that Elias Keach was not even converted and had never been a member of a church in England and was not converted when he got up to preach his first sermon. But he was presenting himself as a minister, basically to make a living, as the indication is. And he began to preach, and probably trying to copy his famous father, Benjamin. And in the middle of that sermon, he broke down in weeping. Later, and confessed that he wasn't even a converted man himself. Confessed his sin to the people he was preaching to. And later on, was actually baptized, joined to one of the churches there in the Philadelphia area, and eventually did become a famous Baptist preacher in the United States. But that's one of the interesting stories of how the particular Baptist tradition was brought to the United States, or connected with it. But now there's a second way in which particular Baptists got off the ground in the United States. And that's the Great Awakening. The Great Awakening was very significant. Now, that's another word that some of you may not, or phrase some of you may not recognize. The Great Awakening. What's the Great Awakening? Who can give me a succinct definition or a description of the Great Awakening? When did it happen? Who was involved in it? What did it do? John Otten? All right. The Great Awakening was a great revival that really spanned two continents. It began to go on almost simultaneously in the 1730s and 40s in England and America. In England, it got off the ground basically with the preaching of George Whitefield in the late 1730s and 40s. There had been a great time of declension after there was toleration for everybody in a kind of golden age for Protestants and nonconformists in England in the 1690s, early 1700s, there had gradually been a terrible, terrible declension throughout the English culture in England. And that was reversed by the coming of George Whitefield, and then later after him, John Wesley and Charles Wesley and the whole Wesleyan Methodists. There were two groups of Methodists, originally Whitefieldian Methodist and Wesleyan Methodist. But that's what happened in England, and the preaching of George Whitefield in England sparked the Great Awakening. But already in New England, there had been a series of revivals that had taken place under Jonathan Edwards and his predecessor at Northampton, Massachusetts, the Congregational Church there, Stoddard. I think it's Samuel, or is it Jonathan? Samuel Stoddard, right. Samuel Stoddard and his successor, Jonathan Edwards, the preachers at the old Puritan Congregational Church in Northampton, Massachusetts, there had been a series of revivals. And when Whitefield came to America, a general awakening began to take place, which was known as the Great Awakening, which is really, in a great sense, the foundation of the whole religious culture in the United States. There had been Christians here, very strong Christian tradition in New England, but that interest became general, and many, many hundreds of thousands of people were brought into the churches through the 1730s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And really was the first thing that really, in a broad sense, brought most of the people in the United States into a kind of Christian consensus, if I can call it that, an evangelical Christian consensus. Now, what you have to understand was that the main preachers responsible for the Great Awakening were all in the Calvinistic tradition. Whitfield was a Calvinist, Jonathan Edwards was a Calvinist, the Tenants in New England were Calvinist, and many, many of these preachers, especially the ones that were responsible for the preaching and the breakout of the Great Awakening in the United States under the hand of God now, were Calvinistic. In fact, Arminians were commonly known to oppose the revival. And so, if you were an Arminian in New England or other places in the United States, that was almost synonymous with being opposed to the Great Awakening because of your doctrinal stance and because of the fact that the very great, very well-known, I should say, preachers and Christian leaders who were Arminian basically opposed the Great Awakening because of some of its successes. They rejected the whole thing. And so, the preachers that got the Great Awakening were used of God in the Great Awakening, were basically Calvinistic. Whitfield and others, Edwards, etc., the Tenants who were Presbyterians. Now, this new life that was being shed from God into the American nation, the young American nation, this new life, however, as almost always will happen, led to the formation, especially in New England, Massachusetts, Connecticut, where you had the great heartland of the old Puritan congregational movement as they have formed these state churches and these what they were called Bible commonwealths in Massachusetts and Connecticut. What happened was a lot of those churches have become more and more dead in the 100 years after they'd been founded by the very, very sincere and genuine and authentic Puritans that came to the United States. But they'd gradually become more dead. And in the midst of this great awakening, there was this new injection of spiritual life in the context of these churches. But this led many, in New England particularly, to form separatist churches. Separatist churches, which split from the old congregational churches that had been originally founded by Puritans 100 years before. Now, they reacted against these churches because they were dead, but also, in many cases, they were quite dead in their spiritual life, but also because they were state-supported, because they were state churches in Massachusetts and Connecticut. In fact, there were state churches in Massachusetts and Connecticut till the 1830s. But they reacted against these things. A lot of the people that were most deeply awakened by the Great Awakening and that revival separated from the old state-supported Puritan congregational churches in New England, formed separatist churches, and then what happened was by the logic of everything they believed, they became Baptist, many of them. And sometimes the whole of these separating congregational churches became Baptist. Sometimes a good deal of the membership would split and become Baptist. Sometimes the preacher would become a Baptist, and he would leave, and a lot of the congregation would go with him and start a Baptist church there in New England. Well, that was the source of the second major group of particular Baptists in the United States. Now, you see the English immigration here and the Great Awakening. The English immigration and the Baptists that came to the United States in the Pennsylvania area, primarily, or as having as that as their center, were called regular Baptist, believe it or not. Now, those regular Baptists really have very little to do with the modern association of Baptist churches called the General Association of Regular Baptists. Now, I'm sure that that organization took the word over because it was a word that was used to describe mainstream Baptist early in the history of America. But regular Baptists were those that held strongly to the London Confession of Faith and had a very strict church order. They had worked, they had had a long time in England to think about how Baptist churches ought to be run and what Baptist churches ought to believe, and they had that all very clearly worked out in their minds, and for that reason they were called regular Baptist. Anybody who wasn't one of them was an irregular Baptist, you see. Well, so you had the regular Baptist that basically came from the particular Baptist tradition in England and it migrated to the United States. But then you had this other group of Baptists. that grew up as a result of these people that were deeply affected by the Great Awakening began to realize that being a member by baptism as an infant of a state-supported church was not sufficient to save. You began to realize that you had to be converted yourself, and therefore, by the whole logic of their position, believing that there ought to be a converted church membership, that pastors ought to be converted if they're going to be pastors, that you have to be converted if you're going to be saved, they began to come to the place where they said, well, therefore, only believers, truly converted people, ought to be baptized and members of churches, and they became Baptist, you see. And so you had the rise of what we're known as now. You have the regular Baptist. Now through the Great Awakening, you have the rise of what we're known as the separate Baptist. The separate Baptist. And they were called the separate Baptist for the very clear reason that they separated from the old Puritan congregational churches in New England, and that's where they got their started. They got their start. But very soon, they became active as a result of the ministry of men like Whitfield and then Baptist preachers who followed him. Whitfield was not himself a Baptist, although he's responsible for the creation of many Baptist churches, not directly, but indirectly. You had these Baptists called the separate Baptist. Now, what you have to realize, of course, is that both the separate Baptist and the regular Baptist were basically Calvinistic. Now, let me show you how that works itself out. In the particular Baptist, first of all, in England, are descended from the English Puritans. It's kind of faint, isn't it? In England, there was this great cleavage between the Anglicans, those who were the people who supported the State Church of England, and those who were Puritans. Now, for a while, the Anglican Church was more or less Calvinistic and Reformed in its theology, but very shortly it began to cease to be that, and the Puritans emerged, and the name Puritan indicates what they were. They believed that the State Church of England needed to be purified. There were all sorts of remnants of Rome that existed in the State Church of England that had to be done away with. And what they wanted to do originally was take over the State Church of England and purify it of all its remnants of Roman Catholicism, and introduced a pure reform religion as the State Church of England. And these Puritans were originally basically Presbyterians. Presbyterians who believed that there ought to be one state church in England that was basically governed by a hierarchy of presbyteries or consistories, presbyteries, classes, synods, and a general assembly which could basically make rules for all the churches in England. These people believed in infant baptism, and they believed that all churches were connected and that there ought to be only one church in a state. These were the Presbyterians in England. Now, Presbyterians nowadays don't believe that for the most part, but they did then. But gradually, as the Puritans began to continue to militate and to agitate and to preach the gospel, and they became more and more influential in the Church of England, they had more and more time, too, to think about church government and how the church ought to be organized. And out of the Presbyterians began to emerge another group of Puritans called the Congregationalists. Now, the Congregationalists were different than the Presbyterians. They believed that every church ought to be basically self-governing, hence they were called independents. That every church ought to be able to govern its own affairs without the interference of a hierarchy of some kind, whether it were bishops or presbyteries. Bishops in the Church of England are Presbyterians and presbyters. And presbyteries in a Presbyterian system. But they still believed in infant baptism and still, to some extent, for a while at least, believed that there ought to be a kind of state church system, although with a lot of respect for local churches. But out of the Congregationalists, in London, in the first decade of the 17th century, there was a very important Congregational church formed in London. And that Congregational church was composed of a great many folk. And over the years, it had at least six daughter churches. And five of those six daughter churches became Baptist. And that was the origin of the particular Baptist in England. The particular Baptist were a kind of Puritan. They were Baptist Puritans. Baptists who believed in the local church, who believed in the separation of church and state, who did not believe in state churches, and who believed in believers' baptism, and not the baptism of infants. Now, that's where the particular Baptist in England came from. But there's a kind of parallel For where the particular Baptist in England, known as regular Baptist in the United States, came from, and where the separate Baptist emerged from. You remember where the separate Baptist emerged from? The state churches of New England were congregational churches. But when they were touched by the hand of God in the Great Awakening, and the life was poured into them from on high, many of those old congregational churches produced a Baptist church. So the Baptists basically emerged out of the ranks of the Congregationalist Puritans. Well, what the point is I'm making is that this whole Puritan movement was, of course, Reformed or Calvinistic. And that included the particular Baptist, and therefore their two wings, the regular Baptist in the United States and the separate Baptist. Now, that brings me to a second point. Unless there are questions, maybe I better ask for questions right there. Any questions about, I've kind of whipped through that. You have a basic idea that the Baptist, the particular Baptist, came out of the Puritan movement, and specifically out of the congregational churches that had grown up in the 1600s. Yes, Steve? Yeah, that's a good idea. Henry VIII was the first one, you remember, to reform the Church of England. Basically, he was interested in money and getting a divorce from his wife. But to do that, he had to tell the Pope to bug off. So he took over the Church in England himself. That was in the 1530s. But then, through the... And that really had very little to do with anything spiritual or religious. But gradually, because his only allies were the people who were Protestants, the Church of England that he had basically proclaimed himself the head of became more and more infiltrated with Protestants, and especially Reformed Protestants from Geneva and from Holland. And these Reformed Protestants began more and more to take over the church until there was basically a Reformed consensus in the Church of England in the 1570s and 80s. But it was at that point that the Puritan Party in the 1570s and 80s emerged that were dissatisfied with the degree of Reformation in the Church of England. And they began to agitate for a more pure church. Therefore, their enemies called them derisively Puritans. And they were basically then saying we need a purified state church, and they began to think about the ways it ought to be purified, and gradually that led to the emergence of the Puritan movement, and then it's basically three great church traditions came out of that: the Presbyterians, the Congregationalists, and the Baptist. Okay? Other questions? John? It's about the same time, and I'm going to talk about that in just a second. The Baptist churches as we know them, and as we that would have any clear relationship to Baptist churches today, emerged in the early 1600s in England. There are other people that believed in believers' baptism before that, but they were peculiar in other ways so that they were not directly related to Baptist as we know them today. All right? Now, the next thing we want to come to is, having talked about the rise of particular Baptists and their roots in America, to talk about their predominance in America. Now, within 50 years after 1740, remember when the Philadelphia Confession of Faith was formally adopted by the Philadelphia Baptist Association, within 50 years after 1740, Calvinistic Baptists had almost buried General or Arminian Baptist in America. Now, you have to understand that in the early 1600s, there were both General Baptist and Arminian Baptist, or General Baptist or Arminian Baptist, and particular Baptist or Calvinistic Baptist in the United States. And they really came about the same time. Perhaps the General Baptist were a little bit earlier, but only 5 or 10 years or so. And they were about equal in strength. But because of the Great Awakening, which is basically Calvinistic in character, those old General Baptist churches, which were pretty weak, actually, and often tainted by heresy. One of the things that happened among Arminian Baptists in England is that many of them became Unitarians and denied the deity of Jesus Christ. But they were very weak and very unorganized. Those General Baptists basically were buried by the particular Baptist, the regular Baptist, and the separate Baptist, in the strength that they had gained through the Great Awakening. And in fact, many Baptist churches that were basically general Baptist were asked for help from the Philadelphia Baptist Association, and they were basically reorganized along the line of regular Baptist churches. That happened especially in the South, where there were some general Baptist churches. And what happened is that those general Baptist churches were so unorganized and so loose that you could be baptized without ever having to give a confession of being converted before the church or before the leaders of the church. And so they had many members that were not even converted. And a lot of the times, the particular Baptists would come in, examine the membership because they've been asked to by these people, and basically cut the membership down from 100 to 15. That's what would happen in many cases in the South. But because of the Great Awakening and the power given to Calvinistic Baptist churches through that, the vast majority of Baptists in America became Calvinistic, and the vast majority of the churches were, after the 1740s. Now, the regular and separate Baptist, however, didn't always get along very well. You can imagine that they had two different perspectives on a lot of things. Here, the separate Baptist, they were kind of reacting against all that staid, old, traditional church order in New England. And they'd felt the power of God and the Great Awakening. And so they were still Calvinistic, but they were kind of reacting against anything too structured and too formal. They were just on fire for God, going preaching the gospel every place, you know. Whereas the regular Baptist had a great awareness of the importance of a strict church order and of doctrinal stability and of a confession of faith. And so a lot of times the two groups of particular Baptists didn't get along at first. But what happened over the next 50 years is that gradually the two groups began to appreciate each other, and you had the merger of the evangelistic zeal of the separate Baptist and of the doctrinal stability and strict church order of the regular Baptist, which really produced, in the combination of the two of them, a very, very strong Baptist movement in the United States, a particular Baptist movement. So the strength of the regulars was their doctrinal stability and strict church order, while the strength of the separates was their evangelistic zeal. And basically they came together then in the later 1700s and worked together in many cases. And that brings me, and this is maybe as far as we'll get today, to their growth in America. Their growth in America. Now, such a combination, as I've said, led to a tremendous growth of Baptists in America. In fact, someone has laid out this chart. In the year 1660, there were basically four Baptist churches in the United States. A couple of them, as I recall, in Rhode Island, and maybe a couple up in Maine. And they were basically mixed, both Arminian or General Baptist and particular Baptist. By the year 1700, there had been a small growth, but not that much. There were 33. Probably this growth was mainly due to the immigration of particular Baptists into the middle colonies in Pennsylvania, in the Philadelphia area. But then you had the coming of the Great Awakening, so that by 1740, 40 years later, there are 96 Baptist churches in the United States. And then 40 years later, there are 457. And the thing just keeps going after that. Till, in the early 19th century, let's say the 1830s and 40s, the two largest denominations in the United States of general groupings of Christians are the Methodist and the Baptist. And they will remain the two largest denominations in the United States until the great immigrations of the late 1800s bring millions and millions of Roman Catholics from Europe into the United States. And at that point, Roman Catholicism will become the largest denomination in the United States. But till that time, Baptist and Methodist, because of their great evangelistic zeal on the frontier of America, will become the two largest groups of Christians. Now, the Baptists that we're talking about now in those early 1800s are primarily, and in the broad view of things, particular Baptist. All right, that's their growth in America. Now, also, as I've mentioned, contributing to this great growth, it was their evangelistic zeal on the frontiers of America. And what helped them to plant churches on the frontiers of America was the tremendous freedom and flexibility of Baptist church polity. And one of the things that was responsible for this was the farmer preacher. And one of the church historians mentions this peculiar individual that was not just one man, but was many different people, and talks about him and about what was responsible for the tremendous growth of Baptist and how they were able to plant so many churches. I quote, "The proliferation of Baptist churches depended above all upon their spiritual vitality and their individualistic emphasis on conversion. Yet, they also were remarkably well adapted to the social structures, or lack of them, on the frontier. Baptists did not exceed Presbyterians in zeal, but they were unhindered by the bottlenecks to evangelistic work created by strict educational requirements and a rigid Presbyterial polity. The genius of Baptist evangelism was also at the opposite pole from the Methodist insistence on order and authority. Its frontier hero was not the circuit rider of the Methodist, but the farmer preacher who moved with the people into new areas. Unpaid, self-supporting, a lot of the time, and hence financially independent, the farmer preacher was usually a man who had heard the call to the ministry and had got himself licensed to preach. In due course, he would be ordained by a church, sometimes one which he had gathered himself. From such churches sprang other candidates for the ministry, and by this process, the Baptist advanced into the wilderness or moved back in among the unchurched multitudes of the older areas without direction from bishops or synods and without financial support from denominational agencies or special societies. On many occasions, an entire church would move on to a new location, just as Lewis Craig's congregation moved from Virginia to become Gilbert's Creek Church in Kentucky in 1783. Baptist work was not as disorganized as all this may imply, however, for their regional associations, usually state associations, fostered a spirit of unity as well as concern for discipline and doctrinal harmony." And so those were some of the reasons for the tremendous growth of the Baptist denomination, and particular Baptist, in the United States. All right. Now, there's just 5 minutes left. Do you have any questions before I come to a last point that I'll just begin to touch on this morning? Yes, Bill? Well, that's a big question. Well, yes, basically. The Wesleyans got off the ground in the United States in the late 1700s. Since they were associated with the Anglican Church, after the Revolutionary War, they met a degree of opposition. In fact, there were a few Methodists in the United States before the Revolutionary War, but because they were connected with the State Church of England indirectly, they lost most of their leadership at the Revolutionary War when they all went back to England and John Wesley denounced the American Revolution. Well, then, however, under the leadership of Francis Asbury, they began to implement the system of circuit riding preachers and were responsible for planting many, many hundreds and thousands of churches on the frontiers of America through a great deal of evangelistic zeal. Because they were Arminian in their basic theology, however, when liberalism began to come in the late 1800s, it didn't even meet a fight in the Methodist for the most part. And basically, the major Methodist groups became very, very quickly honeycombed with liberalism and modernism because of that. Okay? Other questions, Carl? Yes. I should mention that. Yes. Yes. Well, that's a good idea. Carl, why don't you do that? I was just looking at that graph. If you have the book, it'll give you an overview of the entirety of Baptist church history since the Reformation. And if we made 150 of them maybe on the church machine, we could do that. But the book is entitled Introduction to the Baptist by Earl Hulse. I don't know if it's still in print. Maybe, Doug, you could find that out. I don't think so, but if it is, we should get some copies in, and because that's a very, very helpful overview of Baptist church history. Doug? Yes. Yeah, do you have that in stock? Yes. That basically treats a lot of the different avenues of particular Baptist history too, and how they held to the doctrines of grace. Other questions? Now, if you know much about Baptist churches in the United States today, your great question is going to be, well, what happened? Because I don't think anyone would dispute the question or the statement or the assertion that most Baptist churches in the United States today are not particular Baptist churches. They're not Calvinistic in any clear sense at all. How did Calvinism, or the particular Baptist heritage, which at one time, 150 years ago, basically dominated American Baptist churches, how did that almost totally disappear from Baptist churches in America by 1950 or 60, till it was a very rare thing to find a convinced Calvinist who would call himself that among Baptists? Well, the answer to that question is not simple. In fact, it's quite complicated in some ways. But various factors can be pointed out, and I'm going to begin to point those out next week as we take up the debasing of the particular Baptist heritage in America and how it came to be, at its present, very low condition in terms of what Baptists were at one time in the United States. So that's where we'll take it up next week. All right? You're dismissed.